Okay, so here's part two. Michael, thank you very much for your very interesting presentation. I've always learned something when you talk about black raspberries. So originally I was going to try and do both the genetic linkage mapping and the QTL analysis, and then I just realized that wasn't going to happen. So first what we're going to do is we'll go through the genetic linkage mapping process. And then after lunch, if you're interested in going through this G model program, we can do that here on our own, okay? So as Nahla mentioned, this is an enormous project with many, many people involved. And even though I'm sort of the, I will say, face of the Black Raspberry Project, none of this stuff happens without the support and help of all of those wonderful people who work with me on this project. So a little bit about myself. I'm one of those non-traditional students. I couldn't have cared less about high school, didn't care about anything except, you know, dance was my fun that I did. I had to go to school so I could go to dance class. But I went back to school in Oregon and found plants, and from there I decided to go on to get a bachelor's degree at San Luis Obispo, where I got to work with California Ironwood on the Channel Islands, which was just a fantastic experience, and it got me involved in the molecular side. I did a master's degree at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo looking at California thistle, and I vowed after that that I'd never work on anything spiny again. But now I'm working on black raspberry. I did my PhD in New Zealand doing comparative genomics of rosaceae, and so that's how I got into all the genetic linkage mapping. And throughout my various what I'm going to be when I grow up phases, I've been an environmental consultant, I've taught at community college, and I've worked for marker development for a private breeding company. And now I'm working on this postdoc with Nahla and Chad there in the corner on this incredibly spiny black raspberry plant. So you should now have, prior to coming today or this morning, loaded these particular programs and data sets onto your computer. Has everybody done that? Yeah? Okay, perfect. So as I mentioned, if time permits, we'll do the QTL analysis and some other mapping, making your maps pretty kind of thing. So today I'm going to talk about linkage mapping, showing you some different sources of data. So GBS, the genotyping by sequencing data examples, and the SSR data examples, and then how to actually use that to generate a linkage map, and then we will go through the process on the evaluation license using JoinMap. So there's two kind of mapping strategies. There's linkage mapping, which you use segregating populations that have been bred for a particular, often for a particular trait, and you're looking at how that trait segregates within your population. And then there's association mapping, where you have a trait that's distributed around a large unrelated group of individuals. So, for example, at our germplasm repository, we have 1,000 pairs. Some of them are related to each other, but most of them aren't. And so you could do an association mapping on pairs using the repository collection. But we're doing linkage mapping because we have a segregating population, and we are looking specifically at traits that segregate in these populations. And so why do we need a genetic linkage map? Well, how do you get from New Orleans to Missouri? You know, you need a road map. You need to figure out where all those little towns are between here and there that will put you where you want to be. And so each chromosome is a representation, or a linkage group is a representation of a chromosome. And these markers are a roadmap, and little points along that give you a sense of orientation. And this allows us to map out the regions of importance for the traits that we're interested in without having to look over the entire United States to try and pinpoint where that aphid locus is. Okay? And this is a little summary of how you kind of go about developing a linkage map. So you start out with your mapping population up here. There's a mouse here. And you extract your DNA, and you find your markers, and you run the PCRs, and then you get how these markers are segregating within your population. So these are the two parents and 20 individuals. So then you score your markers, you put them into a mapping program, and you get a linkage map that shows where your markers are in relation to each other distributed along the chromosome. And this is from a Collard review paper. It's really quite a nice paper. So I'm going to be talking about GBS data, and Michael didn't introduce GBS, but we're looking at SNP data with GBS. So what we did is we basically chopped the DNA up into pieces and sequenced pieces that had particular adapters on the ends. And so it's a reduced representation of the genome. So there's a lot we're missing, but it also eliminates a lot of the repetitive sequences. And the raw results look something like this, where we have our median reads per line, and a line is an individual. And here it looks like we have 1.2 million SNPs. The average reads per individual is 1.6 million SNPs. Standard deviation is almost as many as my average reads, and that's because I had some individuals that just didn't sequence. And that's going to happen no matter what you do. And then assigned reads are totaling a total of 3 million, and that is because we are aligning to a reference genome. So remember Nahala mentioned that we've sequenced the genome of the black raspberry. So we were able to take all of our fragments, all of the pieces that we sequenced, and align them to the reference genome, but we had 3 million that didn't align. And then this gives you an idea of the number of reads per individual and the number of potential SNPs. Now this looks like, whoa, look at all these SNPs. Well, we're going to talk about that. So this is kind of, you know, an example of what you get when you look at the raw results from a GBS run. So because we have a reference genome, each SNP has a location within the reference genome. And so this S1, that stands for scaffold 1, and this number here, the 8641, is the position on that scaffold. And these are the alleles that were identified at that position, so you're either going to have an A or a G, and chromosome in this case is scaffold in the position, and then this gives us the genotype of the parent. So parent 1 is the female, parent 2 is the male, and you say, well, what is an R? What nucleotide is R? So up here in the corner, I've given you the ambiguity codes, and you can get this offline, just type in DNA ambiguity codes, and you can see that an R stands for either an A or a G. So this is saying that our parent 2 is heterozygous at that position. So what we're looking for is a combination of the A's and the G's, the homozygotes and the heterozygotes at this particular locus. And so you can see we've got about the same number of A's as we do R's in this 10 individuals. In JoinMap, that would be coded as homozygous in the first parent, heterozygous in the second parent. So they'd call that NN by NP. And it looks like we've got a pretty good ratio of each type in the population. This marker here, there's a lot of N's, and N equals ambiguity. It couldn't be called what the SNP was. So that's missing data. And missing data, if there's a lot of missing data, just throw that marker out. It's not worth the trouble of trying to figure out what's going on. Then there are some markers that are the same, or some loci that are the same in both parents. Monomorphic markers may amplify beautifully, but you can't do anything with them, so yes, throw them out. Here's an example where we're heterozygous in the female parent and homozygous in the male parent. And so, and this also looks like a very nice ratio of segregation. Here's one where we've got heterozygous in the female parent and homozygous in the male parent, but we're missing some of the letters we would expect to see. So we've got a lot of missing data, so it's not probably going to be a good marker. And then we have ones that are heterozygous in both parents. And these can be useful in stitching your linkage maps together, but they can be problematic because you can't tell from which allele the allele arose, because they're the same in both parents. So they can be a bit problematic, but they do have their place in genetic linkage mapping. And then I'm showing you these highlighted unsupported alleles. So for example, in this one we've got a homozygous parent, the marker is homozygous in both parents. So where is the C coming from? Because you can't get a G with a C. So things like this with GBS data could indicate a couple of different things. It could indicate that progeny number 7 and is a self. And so you could have a contaminant in your population. Or it could just mean that that particular locus wasn't supported enough, there wasn't quite enough data. Or it could indicate that it's a misread. So with any of those, you need to look at your entire data set to see, do I want to keep that individual? So progeny 7, if it has a lot of unsupported data in lots of different markers, you probably just want to remove that from your population. And I did that with 6 individuals based on my GBS data. I just pulled them out because they had more than I was comfortable with, anywhere from 15 to 90 unsupported data points in my population, in my data set. And so I just removed them. It's better to not include those types of individuals. So when you're looking at your data sets, you want to look at how much missing data do you have per individual and per locus, and then what is the overall quality of each individual and each locus. With SSR markers, again, you've got a little bit more flexibility here. So with SNP markers, it's biallelic. You're going to have one allele or the other. With SSR markers, you can have different types. You can have biallelic, triallelic, and tetraallelic options. And so I've given you an example here of each one. So here, this first marker, we have heterozygous in the female parent, homozygous in the male parent, and we've got, again, a nice ratio. And LM by LL is how JoinMap codes this type of segregation, where it's homozygous in one parent and heterozygous in the second parent. And here's an example of the NN by NP. Again, we've got a nice ratio. This is an example of a tetraallelic SSR, where the parents each have 2 unique alleles. And so you won't see the parental types in your progeny. Everything is getting rearranged. So I've done a color coding here to show you that I've called marker allele 170, I've called A, and this is of course arbitrary based on your calling system, but this is what I did. I called 170 is A, 172 is B, 163 is C, and 165 is D. And so you can see the different combinations that are present in the progeny. Now, just looking at this first 10 individuals, we're not seeing all of the letter combinations represented. So this might be a skewed segregation ratio. When you look at your entire data set, then you can evaluate how useful that marker is going to be. But these tetra and triallelic markers are very useful because you know exactly which parent the alleles are coming from. here's an example of a triallelic marker here. Again, the color coding. So this is an EF by EG. So both parents share one allele and have a unique allele. And so you can see the parental types in your progeny. And again, I've done the color coding, and you can see that all of the different combinations are represented, and it looks like it's going to be a pretty good ratio. Now, one thing about JoinMap is that it can't handle this type of marker here, this AB by CC. The other, you know, heterozygous in one parent, homozygous in the other, one of the alleles is shared in these LM by LLs and NN by NPs. As an example, here's 114 is shared between the two parents, 156 is shared between the two parents. With this option down here on the bottom, 121 is not shared with the other parent. And I tried playing around with this. I tried coding this as AB by CD and making a 121C and a 121D, and I just couldn't get it to work. I ended up causing linkage maps that were 5,000 centimorgans long, and so that's just the JoinMap just was like, I can't figure this out. So these type of markers would be really useful, but not in JoinMap. So that's one of the limitations, is that it has to have either all unique alleles or one allele that is shared between the parents. And so this one, I was really disappointed because it's an SSR marker, but I couldn't use it. If anybody figures out how to use it, please let me know. Okay, so in summary, these are what you're looking for in your mapping set, in your data set. You want markers that are heterozygous in one parent, homozygous in the other, heterozygous in both parents, those are those HK by HK alleles, tri- and tetraallelic SSR markers, you want good segregation ratios, and you want markers and individuals with the most data. And you can set what your threshold is for the most. I tend to be a bit conservative, keeping it around 10% missing data. But you can go as high as about 20%. JoinMap will work with that. So it's just what your comfort level is. And you can try mapping multiple ways to see which one gives you a map that makes sense. Things to discard. If it's monomorphic, even if it's an SSR, throw it out. You can't use it. It's not going to map. If there's lots of ambiguous or unsupported calls, you've got to decide what you're going to do about that. One thing, if you really want that individual or that marker, you can change those ambiguous calls or those unsupported calls to missing data points. It's better to have missing than wrong data. Highly skewed segregation ratios, it's just going to throw your map into chaos, so just throw it out. And if you have lots of missing data, either for an individual or for a locus, it's just best to toss it. Okay, any questions on the data set generation? Paul? So the question is, I had 3 million unassigned reads with the GBS data, and is that a normal sort of result? You know, I'm not exactly sure what normal is, Paul, because every data set is different, and each, how well assembled your reference genome is, and there's so many factors about what is normal. As Michael mentioned, we're working with a very homogeneous sequence, and so we are quite confident that our genome is well assembled. So what Nahla said is, we've got 2,000 scaffolds. We're not completely assembled at this point, but what we have is well assembled. Michael?
I think what I'd add to that is rather than focusing on that number of 3 million reads, if you looked at that chart,
There was a question over here.
Yeah, you mentioned you discarded the given segregation, but usually the segregation distortion is very common, like especially in your writers.
Yes. So you have to make the call on that, of which markers you're going to keep, because some of them will just make your map, again, like I said, 5,000 centimorgans long because it's so skewed. But you have to make the call on... It's very dependent on your population and what markers you're using. There's no one answer to this. And that's one thing about mapping, is it's as much an art as it is a science. You've got to look at how your markers fit together. You need to look at how your population, your entire data set as a whole unit, as well as looking at each individual and each locus. And what takes the longest is figuring out what makes sense for your population. So there's not one answer to this, and that it makes it a little hard, because you know we're trying to give you some answers on how to do mapping, but you've got to just work with your data and massage it. It took me a year and a half of working with this data to get to a map that I felt really represented my population. And I had the advantage of having some red raspberry maps that I could use for some comparison. If you're working with something that's never been mapped before, your first map is the standard. So you have to figure out what is going to work well with your population and with your data set. So I know that's very vague, but that's the way it goes. Yes. So the question is, what pipeline for the SNP calling? And it was a TASL pipeline.
TASL?
Yes. And that's through the
Cornell.
Thank you. Okay. So we have data generated. We have SNP data. We have SSR data. So now you need to decide what size your mapping population is going to be. So this is variable, again, based on how heterozygous your population is, how many individuals you have, and what makes sense economically to actually include for all the PCRs that you're going to have to do. So kind of the guideline is about 100, you know, 96-ish, because that's a plate. And but it's variable. I've seen as few as 72 individuals. I've seen as many as 200 individuals. It just, again, depends on what you can afford and what you've got for heterozygosity in your population. One of the things that you must be clear on when you're putting together your data is that your individuals always have to be in the same order when you're putting your data set together. Because if you don't have them in the same order, nothing is going to work. So when I use Excel, and Excel, if you don't have a zero in front of your, if you have a single digit number, you don't have a zero in front, it goes 110, 100, 101, blah, 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 and then 220, blah, 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 blah. So that's the way I just sort it, and I make sure that everybody is sorted that same way so I can put all of my data in the same order. All of your individuals must have unique names, otherwise JoinMap can't function because it doesn't know if you're talking about 101, or this individual 101, or this individual 101. So everybody has to have their own unique name. And then you've got to convert your marker type to the JoinMap format. And so they have, in the manual, they show you of the different segregation types that you can have, and they have to be between the greater than and lesser than signs. You don't include your parents in your final data set. You use your parents to determine your segregation types and your allele types, but they do not get included in the mapping set. All your missing data is coded as a double dash, And just a little hint on this, if you're using Excel as your data management process, if you hit double dash, it treats it like a minus sign and wants to do math with the next cell that you click in. So the best thing to do is before you convert all of your missing data ends to double dashes, is to do that with your find and replace and have the find and replace with the double dash in it rather than trying to put in an individual double dash in each cell, because it'll just drive you absolutely crazy. It took me a while to figure that out, so I'm passing this little tidbit on to you for free. No spaces in the marker names, maximum of 20 characters, and each marker name has to be unique. Otherwise, JoinMap will yell at you. Okay, so these data sets that we're using today are highly refined. Like I said, it took me a year and a half to get to a mapping point. Many iterations of maps and throwing markers out and putting markers back in and all of this stuff. So I've given you the cream of the crop marker set to play with. I eliminated progeny that didn't amplify or had poor results overall. I eliminated markers that had highly skewed segregation ratios, and I'm talking like, you know, it looks like it should segregate 1-to-1, but it's segregating 3-to-1 for a heterozygous in one parent, homozygous in the other. Or, you know, there's only one or two individuals that have a different combination. So it's highly skewed. And as I mentioned, it takes a lot of time and effort and art to get to this particular point. So these are what your parental data sets are going to look like. And so you have your marker set that's heterozygous in the first parent, your female parent, and you have your marker set that's heterozygous in your second parent, or your male parent. And so what I've shown here is the segregation code. So heterozygous in parent 1, homozygous in parent 2, tetraallelic, diallelic, and then these HK by HK markers. And this one in red is highlighted because it's it's an AB by CD that you can map in both progeny sets, in both parental sets, and allows you to compare your linkage groups, because you're going to construct two different maps, one for parent one and one for parent two. And it's most common for you to have different numbers of markers depending on the parent. So parent one may have as many as a quarter or maybe even twice as many markers as parent two. That's not uncommon to have a very different number of markers between your parents. So if you've got some markers that can that bridge the two parental maps, then you can make sure you're always talking about the same linkage groups, because JoinMap arbitrarily numbers your linkage groups from 1 to whatever based on the number of markers. So linkage group 1 has the most markers, and linkage group 7, for example, has the fewest markers. But that can vary between your two mapping sets. So if you have markers that are in common between the two, you can say, oh, parent 1 linkage group 1 is the same as parent 2 linkage group 3. It's just that there are fewer markers to map for the second parent. Does that make sense to everybody? So just because it says linkage group 3 doesn't mean it's a third linkage group. It's just that's how many markers got assigned, okay? And so those are all arbitrary assignments. And so when you're constructing the very first linkage map of something, most people will just go with the numbers that are given by JoinMap. But then as you get more comparative stuff, then you can evaluate whether or not you want to rename your linkage groups to go with some other better mapped crop or something like that. So here's a screenshot of what it looks like in Excel. And so as you can see, I've got my loci going down the column, my segregation types, and then my progeny missing data points as the double dash. And so my progeny go down and my my markers go across. Okay, everybody ready to have some fun? Because now we're going to do some stuff, okay? So if you could please all open up your evaluation version of JoinMap. And then there's, if you need any help, please let us know, because Paul and Michael and Nahla and I can run around the room and make sure you're getting all in those on the same page. And then let me know when you're there. So does everybody have these three things open? Yes? Everybody open? Yeah? Okay.
I'm not seeing anything that says Join Math Evaluation
Center. That's the program that you should have downloaded before. So
I was unable to download anything.
Paul.
Yeah,
we have it. Well, he got the.
I just downloaded everything.
Do you have a JoinMap 4.1 evaluation? It looks like this, Ed. Yeah, if you weren't able to download the program, then please go ahead and look on to somebody else's computer, because sometimes you don't have admin rights to do the download. Okay, so we've got the evaluation version open, the tutorial data set, which is just an Excel file, and the protocol, which is a step-by-step that you can follow through. Okay, so the first thing you have to do, and I should also preface this, is that my screenshots may look different from your screenshots depending on which environment you're working in. So Windows XP versus Windows 8 or 7 or any of that, the screenshots will look a little bit different, but they all should say the same thing. So the first thing you have to do is you have to click that you're okay on using this evaluation license. And then you're going to end up with this window that looks like this. Okay? And you can see it says project, and then there's project notes, and it tells you that you are working in the evaluation license. So the next thing you're going to do is you're going to go to new project up here in the corner, file, new project. And it's going to ask you to save it somewhere. And just save it to your desktop. This is as soon as you close out of this, everything's going to disappear. So it's just an ephemeral evaluation. Every time you want to work on in the evaluation license, you have to start over again. You can't reopen anything. So just save it to your desktop. And then the next thing you're going to do once you've saved it and given it a name, so call it like ASHS 2015 or would. Test one, or make Jill shut up, or whatever you want to call it. And you're going to create a new data set. So go to data set, create new data set. And then you're going to open the Excel file. Now, previous versions of JoinMap made you import data from a text file. So this is a huge advantage in the version 4 is that you can actually just copy and paste your data directly into that project window. And it lets you fix your errors there rather than having to keep going back to your text file and stuff. So this is a very nice feature of the version 4 and 4.1. So select the tab that's labeled Parent 1, 2LG, and Errors on it. And you will see that there are 100 progeny. So if you click in the first column of the progeny and you tab out to the end, you'll see that there are 100 progeny. And if you do that for the markers, you start at the top and you tab down to the bottom, you'll see that there are 60 markers. Markers that are prefixed with an S are SNP markers. Those are the ones from the GBS data. And all the other markers are SSR. I've included a marker with a skewed segregation ratio so that you can see how that affects your map. And there are two errors included in this data set. And then there's a second parental data set as well. And there's a tab for parent one without the errors. So parent one has two tabs, one with two errors and one without the errors, but they're otherwise exactly the same. So you're going to start here with this, so you're going to create new data set, and this is the window that you get. Everybody here? Yeah, everybody here? Okay, so you've got this big gray screen with this little tiny square in the corner. So then what you're going to do is come down to the bottom here where it says pop name down here at the very bottom, and you're going to give your population a name. So parent one, for example.
Are you wanting to do the one with error or without
one? Whichever one you want. It doesn't matter. I'm going to show you how to fix the errors in this. So give your population a name, and then you're going to fill in the number of loci, which is 60, and your number of individuals, which is 100, and then your population type over here is a drop-down menu. And you want to go to CP. And you'll see that when you select CP, that it fills in the entire window. So let me show you here, okay? So by choosing CP, it fills out all of the information that you're going to need to input. Okay, is everybody here? Okay, so I'm going to go back up one slide just to talk about this controlled pollination. So you'll see that there are lots of options for population types in JoinMap. And we're using the CP, a controlled pollination, which is also a simulated backcross, a pseudo backcross. So you have these various types of segregation options, which we talked about already, heterozygous in one parent, heterozygous in the other, heterozygous in both, triallelic and tetraallelic. And you're creating two maps, one for parent, the markers that are heterozygous in parent one, and one that are heterozygous for the parent, for the markers in parent two. So that's what the CP gives you, that kind of flexibility. So you make the choice of which population type to use based on the kind of breeding system that your crop has. We're going to use this one because in Rosacea, this works for us. Okay, so here we are in this data set window. Okay, so now what you can do is copy from the Excel spreadsheet the first two columns, which are locus and segregation, and just paste them into these two columns here. So you'll have your locus and your segregation starting below the thick line. Yes? We're going to copy and paste it. Yep, that's all we're doing. So that's what we're doing right now. So you're going to copy and paste. Yes?
Are we copying starting on row 2 or row 1?
Row 2.
So you're copying just the segregation, just the data. Yes. Yeah. So 2A and 2B all the way down to the bottom.
The number of individuals in the
It's 60 loci, actually. This is an old screenshot. It's 60 loci. Sorry, this is an older screenshot. Okay, so you should have, in these two columns, 60 loci and 60 segregation types. Is that correct? Everybody there? Okay. Then the next thing you're going to do is copy from the progeny all the way down all of the genotyping. So if you click in that first cell that, let me go back here to the screenshot here. So if you start here in C1, copy all the way out to the end, and then all the way down, and then you're going to paste that. So everybody's at that point, clicking in C1, copying all the way, highlighting all the way across and all the way down, so you get that big block of data. Then you're going to click in this first cell here that's under the number 1 above the thick line. And you're going to paste all of that in. So you're going to have all of your progeny above the thick line and all of your data set down below the thick line. Everybody there? Okay, so right now it looks like all your progeny are named 4. And that's just because the cell is contracted as far as it can go. If you want, you can expand the width of the cells as you do in Excel. But for now, we're just going to keep it small so that we can see as much data on one page as possible. Now there's two other empty columns. There's phase and classification. And JoinMap will fill that information in for you. You don't have to do that. So when you go to actually process your data, it will fill those two columns in. So the only things you need to put in are your marker names, your segregation types, your progeny, and then everything that you've scored. Okay? Now, what we're going to do now is, okay, so we've got all these things in here. Everybody's at this point, right? Okay. We are going to go up to data set and highlight errors. If you've used the error data set, you're going to get a little reading down here in the bottom that says locus name contains a space in row 1. So then you can go into that particular cell in the data set here and remove that space. It's right after the underscore. So that, and then there's a second error where I have an N instead of a double dash. And you double click in the cells that you want to make the changes in, and then you can make that change. Make it into a double dash. Turn that N into a double dash.
So once you've corrected those two errors, you can go back up to data set, highlight errors, and you'll see that in the corner it says no coding errors detected.
So if you've only got a few errors, it's easy enough to fix them in JoinMap. But if you've got several, I recommend going back to your Excel data sheet, fixing them there, and repasting the data. Because this interface here is not always the easiest to negotiate, because you can't highlight a row or a column and scroll. It won't let you do that. And when you're working with particularly large data sets, it can be hard to identify where you are in this big mess, this big matrix. So I included these two errors in places that are easy to fix in JoinMap, but if you have lots of errors, just go back, fix them, and bring the data back in.
So is everything you're running is about the first entry?
No, just the space in the...
Which space is it?
It's right after the underscore, between the underscore and the S. So the error in the name, the space in the marker name, is between the underscore and the S. Then you go back to data set highlight errors, and it'll be gone. Okay. Everybody got their errors fixed? Okay. So, go back up to data set highlight errors, and you'll get the no coding errors detected message down there in the bottom. I wish they would make it a little flashier, you know, like, hoo-hoo, you did it, no errors, but they don't. They're Norwegian people, and they're very stoic. Okay, so now you have a clean data set. Next is to create a population node, and we're going to create a population node for just the first parent at this point. After lunch, if you want to practice again with the second parent, we can do all of this again, but right now we're just going to focus on the first parent. So there's two options when you do this, and I'm just going to show you here. So if you go to data set, create population node, you'll see that there's two options. There's create population node, and there's create maternal and paternal population nodes. Now, we've already gone to the trouble of dividing our data set into two parental sets. If you are working with a data set where you haven't separated out your parent types, you can choose that second option. However, if you do that, you will lose everything that is not biallelic. You'll lose your tetra and triallelic markers. It won't recognize them. So we are going to stick with create population node and do two nodes, one for each parent. And that way we can use as much data as we have. Okay? So again, this depends on your breeding system. And for CP populations, this is what works best. Okay, so create population node, and we now have parent one population node. So we got a yellow square with a big P in it. Okay, and then you're on your info tab, and it tells you the information about your data set. So we've got a population name, so whatever you called your population. We've got the population type, which is CP. We've got 60 loci and 100 individuals. Everybody got that? Okay. Now, we have two different mapping algorithms, and I'm not going to go into any detail on these because you can read about it in the JoinMap manual, and they do a much better job of explaining it. But we're going to focus first on the regression method, and this will add loci one by one, starting with a pair of loci that it recognizes as being the best fit, and then it keeps adding markers in one at a time. And we're going to choose which, whether we're going to use Kosambi or Haldane. And so we'll go through each one of these different steps. But this is just a comparison of regression and maximum likelihood. But again, if you want to read more about the actual statistics and everything that go behind that, I am not the person to talk to about that. I hit a button and I get a map. Okay. So now we're going to, under data set create population node, we're going to select the grouping tree tab. So all the way down to the end. So you're in your population node window. All the way at the end, there's groupings tree. You see that? And you're going to go to calculation options. Under the options menu
Do you have to have the groupings tree selected?
Yes. Yes, you have to have groupings tree selected, and then you can go to options, calculation options. Everybody there? Okay, so then you get this window that pops up, calculation options. Ed, what's up?
Yeah, I must have missed a step. I'm learning groupings tree and nothing comes up.
Yeah, now you've got to go to options, calculation options. Okay, so you get this calculation options window, and we're going to go through some of the different options that you have. So this first tab is population, and we are going to stick with the parameter, the grouping parameter. Well, okay, first of all, sorry, similarity thresholds. You can change this. The default is 95% similarity. That works for most things. So I don't really play around with these default values too much when I'm mapping. But you're more than welcome to try and see how that changes your map. The grouping is what I choose to play with. So you've got different parameters that you can use. You've got your independent LOD, and LOD stands for log of odds. And this is just a ratio of the probability that something is linked versus the probability that it's not linked. So independence LOD and linkage LOD are really just kind of inverse of each other. An independence LOD is the probability that the markers are not linked, and the linkage LOD is the probability that they are linked. So it's kind of the same thing, just looking at it from two different angles. Then there's also your p-value and your recombination frequency. So I recommend when you're playing with this that you go through and click on each of those different options and see how it changes your map. But for now, we're just going to stick with the independence LOD. And then you have these threshold ranges. So we are working with the independence LOD, so we are going to make changes in that first set of cells. And we're going to start with a LOD of 3. Sorry. So we're going to change this independence LOD. Instead of starting at 2, we're going to start at 3. So just change that 2 to a 3. And everything else we're going to leave the same because we're not looking at those other options. Okay, everybody there? Okay. The next thing, we're going to go to the group tab. And the only thing we're going to change here is the mapping algorithm. We're going to make sure that it says regression mapping. So make sure instead of maximum likelihood that the regression box is checked. Everybody there? Yes? No? Maybe?
Yes?
Okay. Everything else we're going to leave as default. And now on the regression mapping tab, we're going to choose Kasambi's mapping function. And again, we're just going to leave everything else default. You're more than welcome to play with these, but for now, just to get through the process, we're going to go with these simple changes, okay? The next tab is the maximum likelihood, and for now we're just going to ignore this. We're not going to do maximum likelihood. We can do it later on if you are interested. And then the last one is the map tab, and we're just going to leave everything as default here. Okay? So we've changed. We're making sure we're doing a regression. We've got our independence LOD starting at a value of 3, and we're using Kasambi, okay?
And what's the significance of having changed it to 3?
Okay, so it's a log of odds. So 3 is 1,000, so it's 1,000 times more likely that what you're seeing is linked rather than not linked. So the higher you go in a LOD score, the more confident you can be in the connections between your markers.
If you choose a number that's too high, then you end up with more linkage groups than your organism has. If you have a number too
Yes. Did everybody hear that? So a log score that's too low, you don't get separation between your groupings. And a log score that's too high, you get lots of little tiny groups. So you've got to, again, find the right ratio for you. Thank you, Michael. Okay, so now we're going to go to this button called Calculate. So you see it's got a little calculator. So you can click the calculator icon. You can click the Calculate menu option, or you can hit F9. All of these things will do the same thing. I usually just typically hit the calculator button. Okay, you guys ready? Okay, click your button. All right, so we're going to be on the groupings tree tab. And you see that we have two nodes. That's good because we have two linkage groups in this data set, right? Because that's the limit of the evaluation license. And so what we're seeing is the first node is, so the first number is a 3.0, that's your log score. Then there's a slash and a 1. And that slash and 1 don't have anything to do with the mapping. It is something that's an artifact of the programming that they did, and it really doesn't mean anything. What's important is your log score and the number in parentheses, which tells you how many of your loci are on that linkage group. Okay? So we have the first node, slot 3, has 31 loci. And the second node has 29 loci. So again, that's arbitrary based on the number of markers in the linkage group. So you want to right-click and select both of those nodes. And they're going to change color. Depending on what platform you're working on, they may turn pink and then red, or they may turn blue. So right-click and pick those. Over on the side, you can see which loci are actually in your linkage group. Okay, so does everybody have those selected? Right-clicking to select those. Okay, so here we are right now. We've got our data entered. We copied and pasted from Excel. We've created a population node for our data set, parent 1. We've got our groupings. Now, these are not maps yet. These are just groupings. And we've selected our groups for mapping. So we're using regression, Cosambi, and a lot of 3. Okay, everybody there? Okay. So, you've calculated, let's see, did I miss a step? Click on your info tab. Is anything there? Let me see where I am. I took some vacation beforehand, and I don't exactly remember what I was doing here. Okay. So let me just think. Okay, yes. All right. So go to your info tab. And so we've got our information. And then the next tab is the data tab. So if you click on that, that's just all of your data. Now, the loci tab. This allows you to exclude individual loci if you want to see what your map will look like without them, without having to go back and remove them from the data set. So it temporarily excludes them, but does not eliminate them. So this is a very useful one. If you've got a marker that is throwing things off, you can remove that from the calculation and try it again without it, without having to go back to your original data set. So that's very useful.
And if you're throwing things off,
there are errors or it's not really a good fit with that particular group, but JoinMap doesn't quite know what to do with it, so it puts it with that group. And we can talk about that a little bit later. The next tab is your individuals tab. And again, it's the same thing. If you have an individual that is not performing very well or it's throwing things off, you can eliminate it with, you can exclude it without eliminating it. Okay, the next one is locus genotype frequency. And when you first click on this tab, it's empty. So what you do is you click the little calculator and it will populate your window. So everybody hit calculate. Everybody hit calculate? Okay. So these are ordered just by however it was entered into the program. You can sort by any one of those headings up here. So if you click on any of these, you can sort by that particular heading. So if you sort on significance, then it will show you those markers that are skewed significantly from what is expected. Or you can sort by chi-square and get the same thing. If you click once, it goes from low to high. If you click again, it goes from high to low. So what this is showing you is how each marker is segregating for its marker, for its segregation type. So the classifications for each segregation type are the different combinations of alleles that you can have with that particular segregation type. So for LM by LL, you can have LMs by LLs. For EF by EG, you can have EF, EG, EE, and FG. Okay, does that make sense? So you can see here, for example, marker ME13CFO8, the second one here, has 10 EEs, 29 EFs, 28 EGs, and 29 FGs. So ideally, this would be segregating 1 to 1 to 1 to 1. So we're a little bit low on the EEs. And you can see here that there are two stars for it being a little bit off from what's expected. So you have to decide if that is okay for you or if that's a problem. That's where this art part comes in. Okay, so everybody's seen how you can sort through these tabs, through these, through the different headings? Okay. The next is the individual genotype frequency, and this tells you how often an individual has a particular genotype. So, for example, for individual one, it has 7 loci in which it has a score of FG. And it has 9 loci for which it has a score of HH. Okay, so you can see that most of its loci, it scores as LM. And then it has 3 missing data points. Okay, so does that make sense to everybody? Okay. Then you have similarity of loci. Again, you'll need to calculate this. And remember, we had the opportunity to change the similarity in the calculation options at the very first window. And we left it at 95. So this is looking at how two loci compare to each other, how similar they are to each other. So in this case, it's looking at locus 1, which is RO18036, and comparing it to RO6594 and showing that they're 95% similar. This pair of markers down here, scaffold 14, blah, 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 and scaffold 798, they're 97% similar. So the more similar the loci are to each other, the less informative they are. So again, once you construct your map, you can decide if you want to pull some of those markers out that are highly similar to each other.
What's the disadvantage of having several highly similar?
Well, they all map to the same position, and so it doesn't really give you much information. The advantage of it is that, of keeping them, is that different populations will be, have different similarities at that particular locus. So it might not be different in my population, but it might be different in your population. So this is just an additional spot on the roadmap for later on for the comparative work. But for your initial map construction, sometimes it can get very busy in that area if you have lots of markers that are scoring the same. So you just might want to prune them out to make your map more readable. Okay, the next tab is similarity of individuals. Again, this is something that we can change on that first calculation options window. And we show that two of our individuals have a similarity of 95%, individual 102 and individual 74. This is good. It means that we have diversity within our population and we're not working with everybody being the same, which frankly, to me, is very surprising in this population because it is so homozygous, but there's enough genetic diversity that we're able to do this. So, whew. Okay. Next is the groupings text tab, and this is just, if you wanted to copy and paste this into a text file, you can do that from here. But what it's showing, I've scrolled all the way down to the bottom, and to show you that it's showing that there are no loci that are identical. We had 97%, but we didn't have 100%. And we have no loci that are excluded at this point. So this I don't really do much with this tab. It's just it's helpful if you have to go into a different kind of program. Okay, so now we're going to, so we've right-clicked our groups. When we're going to, if you click on the little plus sign that's by each of the tabs, it will expand the node. The fact that it's all condensed into one spot shows you that there's no markers that are breaking out as you increase your log score. Again, that's because this is a highly refined data set specifically for this class. So go ahead and click on the plus signs, and you'll see that you'll get a little, I don't have a picture of it. You'll get a little ladder, and it shows that all of the markers are holding together all the way through to log 10, which is where we maxed out. Okay, is everybody seeing that? If you had markers that were breaking out as your log scores were increasing, you would see that. It would show them as they break out based on the different log scores. So as I say, this is not usual for everything to stick together so nicely all the way up to log 10. That's because I've given you a nice, clean data set. Okay, we're getting there. So now we're going to go, staying on that groupings tree tab, we're going to go to population, and we are going to create groups using the groupings tree. These other options, the grouping node and using a map node, those are if you're adding markers to existing maps. We're starting with a new map, so we're going to create groups using the groupings tree. And then you're going to get this little indent here that has a little kind of tree-looking thing and the two nodes. Everybody there? Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so the question is, if you've got lots and lots of markers, when you create your groupings tree, you're going to have lots of nodes. And how do you determine which ones are actually part of your map? And that gets into looking at how what you've set your log threshold at, how many markers per linkage group. If you've got a grouping with a 200 loci in it, you probably need to increase your linkage score and bring that down a little bit. Actually, it's not so much the number of loci, it's the length of the linkage group. Linkage groups over 100 centimorgans are probably artifacts. So you want to look for linkage groups of with a length of centimorgans, usually, you know, 50 to 100, depending on how many markers you actually have. And again, this goes back to the art of it, figuring out what makes sense. So I have 7 chromosomes that I need to be mapping. So if I have 14, then I know my log scores are too high, and I need to relax those a little bit and see how they will fit together. But if I have only 3, then I don't have enough. I need to increase my log score to break them up based on the similarity indexes and recombination rates and things like that. Michael?
Just add to that your linkage group size is also going to depend a little bit on the marker types that you're using. So, for example, if you are using a combination of SNP data and SSR data, that tends to make your linkage
Yeah, so combinations of data, combinations of marker types can lead to slightly exaggerated linkage group lengths because you're working with different types of data. But those SSR markers are really useful because they're transferable across populations and they can be used for anchoring. And so you might exaggerate it a little bit, but they're very useful markers. And as you refine your map over time, you're adding more markers, your linkage group lengths will change. Again, if you're starting with the first linkage group, you get what you get, you know, because you have nothing to compare it with. But as more stuff happens and you refine your map, like there's a red raspberry linkage map that's been being, this population's been being worked on for like 10 or 15 years. And they keep refining it and keep refining it and keep refining it, and it just changes all the time. So this is not a set in stone thing. It's a pathway. Okay, so click. Click on the little map icon there. Everybody clicked? Yes? Okay. You get this. What is this?
You need to click on the groups.
Everybody on this session log? Yes? Okay, so the most important thing about this session log is this thing right here that I highlighted. Sufficient linkage in data to complete the map. If there's an issue, you will see it there. Okay, so we are not going to scroll through this, but this is where you can see what markers that the program started with and how it added each additional marker. So you can feel free to scroll through that at a later time, but we're not going to worry about it right now. So the next thing you're going to do is click on map number one. So there's group one, there's mapping one, and then there's map one, two, and three. Here's your map. This is the map of group one. Yay! So remember we had two groups, group one and group two. So this is the map of group one, and you see that there are three versions of this map. With regression mapping, the first version and the second version often are your best supported versions. The third version is the hammer and the chisel version, where JoinMap just crams every single marker in to try and get it to fit. So you can see quite a difference between your first version and your third version. And this again comes down to markers with segregation ratio skewing and missing data and things that make it difficult to actually position the locus. So for example, if you want to compare your map side by side, you can go to join and combine maps. And you see it has two little icons here. This shows you maps next to each other. The second option on that window, combine groups for map integration, is when you're ready to compare or construct your consensus map, which takes the linkage groups from the from both parents and combines them into a single map. And that's often what you'll see in a publication is a consensus map. Is it showing the markers for the population rather than for the parents? Does that make sense? But we don't have the data to do that yet because we're not calculating parent two. So all we're going to do is combine the maps so that we can look at them side by side. So join and combine maps. And that, so I've pasted these together so you can see them together. You can't see them together on your window because JoinMap won't let you look at it, won't let you extend the size of the page. So you're seeing map one and two together, and then if you go to the other page, you'll see map three. So there's up here at the top, you'll see it says page one of two, and then there's an arrow and a magnifying glass, so that's how you can navigate between the pages. So I've put them all together here. Map 1 and map 2 are identical to each other. Map 3 has this big gap down here in the bottom between 57 centimorgans and 72 centimorgans. And what we're seeing here is the addition of this S97 26383. That's the marker that I put in with the skewed segregation ratio, just so you can see how skewed segregation ratios affect the map. So we went from 61 centimorgans to 72 centimorgans because JoinMap wanted to shove that marker in. Otherwise, it ignored it because it didn't fit very well. So you can see how it's changed. Most of the markers are in the same order between maps 1 and 2 and map 3, but the addition of this S97 has skewed things. So one of the things you have to think about when you're doing this is how important is that marker and what does it do to your map? Can you go back and compare within your entire data set and see if maybe you have some calls that don't make sense? Like maybe there's some double recombinations. Yes?
How did you get all three?
I had to paste them together just to show here.
Okay.
Yeah. So you can see two at one time, and then you have to navigate over to the third page. So I put them all together so you could see them. And if you look at the handout, they're all together in the handout. That's one of the problems with this map charting version that works within the JoinMath environment, it is not friendly. You can't change page sizes or things like that to see things all together. Yes, Suji. Again, it depends on your data set. If you're working with lots and lots of markers, then the maximum likelihood is a better option, but it does take quite a bit longer to process. But it just depends on what you're doing. Yeah, Paul.
Suppose if you click, I'm not tall, so again, that little arrow there,
yes.
The drop down, if you combine two pages and see.
Oh, you can. Well, excellent.
So,
okay, do that. Because I know I can navigate to the next page from there, but I've never actually done the other thing. Well, okay, cool. So anyway, this is just to show you, you know, what happens when you have markers that don't fit really well, and how JoinMap accommodates those markers. Did that answer your question, Suji? I'm sorry. Okay. So let's quickly look at map 3. So go to highlight map 3 here. And go to the locus genotype frequency tab and choose calculate. Okay, so click on map 3, locus genotype frequency tab, which is here at the end, and calculate. And you'll see down here at the bottom this highly, highly skewed locus S97, which is what was throwing the map off for group 3. Everybody see that? So you see it's got lots and lots of stars there, showing that it's highly different from what is expected. And you can see that it segregates 70 LLs to 30 LMs. So that's segregating 3-to-1 when you would expect it to be segregating 1-to-1 as an LM by LL locus. So again, this you have to figure out how does it work with the whole data set. Again, because this is a very limited data set, it might not throw the map off that much if you have more markers. So you have to work with, you know, your data set and see how the loci that have skewed segregation affect how the markers fit together. And that's going to vary with how many markers you have per linkage group. Fewer markers per linkage group, anomalies like that throw things off more than if you have lots and lots of markers. Yes? Yes, exactly. So because this is a SNP locus, I'm basing this on the GBS data and the quality of the pipeline and the parameters that we set for that pipeline can affect how that can affect the quality of the data that comes out. So again, SNP data, if I have a marker that's a SNP data that's giving me problems, I'm more likely to throw it out because I can't test that marker. If I have an SSR marker that's giving me problems, I can run that again in the lab and reevaluate and say, oh yeah, I scored that wrong, or you know, the DNA quality was bad. If I run it with a better DNA quality, I get a better marker. But I can't do that with SNP data because it's all computer generated. So I'm more likely to throw out a SNP marker that's giving me problems than I am an SSR marker. I'll go back and I'll futz with the SSR marker if I can get it to work, then I will. But yeah, so the different parameters that you have set for all of your different options largely affect the outcome of your map. So you've constructed a genetic linkage map. Woo! Everybody, high five. Hey? Okay. So I'm just about done. These are what maps are construct, you know, why we do it. And here's an example of an SSR that is associated, or a SNP that is associated with a QTL that we can talk about later. And thank you to all the people who've been involved in this project. Thank you. Okay, so who's all interested in the QTL stuff? Okay. So this mapping program is a freely available, bare bones program that was written by Rex Bernardo, University of Minnesota, and these are the two references that you can look at his actual papers about how he developed these programs. So I experimented with this program because it is free and it's something that anybody can use. I did not have an opportunity to compare it to, say, MapQTL, which is the join map groups version of a QTL mapping program. So I don't know how it compares as far as how well it detects or doesn't detect QTL. All I can do is walk you through how to use this particular program with a data set that I've provided with to you. So it's, again, it's not a comparison, it's just how to use this particular program, okay? So the outline of the program and is a in the handouts that I gave you with the G-model protocol is all in here as well. But the thing is, it estimates the effect of a particular locus compared to the whole genome. So not just a chromosome, but every marker in your map. It starts with chromosome 1, and it goes through one at a time until it reads all of the different markers in order by chromosome. And it uses a multiple regression method to find these associations. And it does this iteration over and over until you cover all of the chromosomes in your species. So all of the files that you need to use have to be in the same folder. So you have to have your AM chromosome, the AM SNP, the AM phenotype, and the G-model executable program all in the same place. And the file names are not case sensitive, but you cannot have any spaces. And he recommends that you use an underscore rather than a dash when you're naming things. So I provided examples of each of these files that he provided to me, and then I also have examples of what my data looks like in these formats. So the first thing to do is construct your chromosome file and your SNP dataset files. So for this type of program, you are only using your biallelic markers. Doesn't matter if it's a SNP or an SSR, as long as it's a biallelic. So the LM by LLs and the NN by NPs and some of the HKs by HKs. You're going to convert all of your heterozygous calls to zero and all of your homozygous calls to either one or negative one, depending on so if you have ones that are heterozygous in both parents, your HH allele will be 1, your HK alleles will be 0, and your KK alleles will be negative 1. Okay, so that's just an arbitrary assignment, but your opposite homozygotes have to be coded either 1 or negative 1. Does that make sense? Yeah, okay. And I'll show you examples of what I mean by correcting the phase and imputing missing data. And then you need to prune out markers that are redundant. So we were talking earlier about when you have multiple markers mapping to a single location, that's just a lot of noise for this program, for GModel. So what you're aiming for with a QTL map is markers that are well distributed along the linkage group. It doesn't have to be particularly dense, but this gives you an idea of where to focus so that you can then add more markers to that particular area and make a better map for that area. So it gives you a target of where to focus. So you don't want markers that have high correlation with each other, which means they're very similar. So he recommends removing markers that have values that are close to one as being their level of similarity. Again, there can be some flexibility in this, and again, this goes back to some of the art that is involved in doing this kind of work. So your Chrome file, so all of these are going to be comma-separated files, and it's going to have, and I'm doing all of my, you know, data management in Excel, but if you have some other program that you're using, the outcome is the same. You're just going to have it importing it from a different program. But because it's a CSV, it's all kind of just text anyway, right? So you're going to have two columns without headers. One of them is your marker name, and the other one is the chromosome on which that marker falls. That has to be in order from one to whatever. The markers themselves do not need to be in order on the chromosome, but I found that it was just simpler to go from my genetic linkage map and keep everything in the same order and not have to worry about where things were falling in relation to each other. So for me, it was just simpler to take my join map data, copy that and paste it into a new Excel file, remove my redundant markers, but keeping everything in order based on the linkage map. So that may or may not work for you, but I found that to be the most useful method for me to go through the data. So your markers names can have no spaces and can't be more than 30 characters long, which is fine because JoinMap won't let you go over 20, so you're going to be okay. Chromosome names should be numbers only, so 1 through 7 in my case. And again, the SNPs should be ordered by chromosome, with chromosome 1 at the top and chromosome 7 at the bottom. So here's an example of what my data looks like in Excel. So it's, you can see I have chromosomes 1, 2, and 3 displayed here, and there's no headers. Okay, headers, he doesn't let you do headers or any labeling whatsoever. The important thing, and this is why it's easier for me to keep everything in order, is that your chromosome, the order of your markers on your chromosome has to be in the same order as your SNP file. So I find that it's just easier to keep everything in the map order rather than sorting alphabetically or, you know, some other method. So if you look at the mapping data that we used earlier, you'll see that these markers are in that order, but there's fewer of them because I've had to eliminate anything that was not biallelic. So all the EFIEGs and AB by CDs, they get removed from this data set. So your SNP file, the rows are corresponding to your markers, and the columns correspond to your individuals, so just like in the join map data. And again, the order of the SNPs has to be in the same order as the markers in your chromosome file. Your genotypes are coded as 1 for the homozygote and 0 for the heterozygote. and we talked about that already, and there cannot be any missing data. Now, some programs are more flexible on that one, but this one isn't. So here's an example of what the SNP file looks like. Again, there's no headers. There's nothing to distinguish where you are. So I make copies of every screen that I'm using, every tab that I use, I make copies so I can go back to an original and make changes on a copy. So if I, you know, everything explodes, I have the originals to go back to. So your headers, there's no headers. Your rows are your markers. Your columns are your individuals. And again, the markers have to be in the same order as they were in the chromosome file. Does that make sense? Really? Or are you just nodding? Okay. All right, your phenotype file. Your rows correspond. So now you're going rows are your individuals, and the columns are the traits. Now this is where it can get a little bit tricky. Depending on the trait you're measuring, you may have a different set of individuals for each trait. For example, I can score all of the individuals in my population for vigor, but not everybody is fruiting because I have some plants that are sterile. So I have to have a data set, I have to have a set of individuals for vigor, and I have to have a different set of individuals that I use for fruiting characteristics because they're a totally different, or you know, they have individuals in common, but there'd be missing data if I tried to use the vigor individuals for the fruiting characteristics because some of mine just don't fruit. So you can analyze more than one trait at a time if you have the same individuals for that trait. So if I was doing fruit quality and fruit ripening, I could use the same data set, the same individuals, because I won't have any fruit quality traits if I don't have any fruit, right? But, and I can use the same vigor scores if I'm scoring something that is universal to the population and everybody is producing that particular trait. So this can take some time to figure out which individuals are you're gonna use for that trait evaluation. So your lines or your individuals need to be in the same order as they are across the top of your SNP data file. And you can have only one entry per trait. So if you have a trait that is measured over various locations or various time frames, you either analyze each of those data sets individually or you average all of your data into one score. So it just depends on how you want to look at this data. And again, there cannot be any missing data. Okay, so here's an example of where you can have a header. This is an example of a phenotype file. So my header, my trait name is average fruit ripening. There's no spaces in that. The order of my rows is the same as the order of my columns in the SNP file. And again, no missing data. You getting a hint that you can't have any missing data? Okay. So this is what a screenshot looks like of this program. And when I say bare bones, I am not kidding. So for this example, we're looking at one trait. And you can set your significance level from being fairly loose, closer to one, or very stringent, farther than, much less than one. And this is why it's important for all of your files to be together, because the program can't go looking for files that are in different folders. So you enter in your your marker name and chromosome, so that's your AM Chrome file, and I've labeled mine AM Chrome 3021-2, which is one of my parents, .csv. Then you enter in your marker data, which is all your SNP data, your phenotypic data, which is your AMFEN file, and then you give it an output name. And so I've called it 3021-2 Fruit Ripe QTL Trial 4 in this case. Now, the other thing about this program, if you make a mistake when you're typing and you've already moved to the next line, you have to just reopen the program. It won't let you go back and make corrections. So be very careful when you're typing, because I had to type things in over and over again, and you know, try not to make any typos, because it's like, I don't know where this file is, and it gives you errors, and you're like, oh, what did I do? So when I was learning to use this, I took a screenshot before I hit go every time. So if I got an error, I could go back and look at this and say, I typed QTM instead of QTL, or you know, something like that. Michael.
I've run into the same thing when you run the instruct, it's a DOS command line thing, and so you have the same limitation. But if you run into that, what you can do is if you press the up arrow, it automatically gives you the command line that you typed in for the previous command, and then you can do back arrow, scroll back to find your error, and
I have used that before, but I don't know that this one actually lets you do that. But you can try it. You can try using the up arrow. This one is really, really picky.
It's nice.
Yes.
Are we going to walk through this?
Yes. Yes. So I just wanted to show you what the screenshot looked like. So before you hit enter, after you've typed in your output file, I suggest you take a screenshot, paste it in your Excel file, just to have a record of what you did. Okay, so this is what the output looks like. And it comes up as a CSV in the folder where all of your other files are. So this tells me I have 126 markers, 80 individuals, my significance level, and that I have a QTL associated with marker S134 on chromosome 2 with a marker effect of 4 and a p-value of 7 to the -6. Okay, so that's pretty good. And what this says is that it's explaining a 4-day difference in ripening from the average. So it's 4 days earlier than the average ripening. So whether or not this is significant to breeding, again, that's another question like what Paul was bringing up. Is 4 days enough to do anything with it? So the really good thing about it, though, is that this locus is located between two SSR markers. So this gives us a very targeted area, and it's only over about 5 centimorgans. So if we decide that this is something to pursue, we've got a nice little nugget to work with. So what we can do is walk through the program. So if you open up the QTL spreadsheet that I sent you, I'll walk you through how I went and put that data set together, and then we'll use this data set as I've shown you here. So there's kind of two things to go about here. There's how you go about cleaning up the data and then using a cleaned up data set to get these results that I just showed you. Okay? So I don't have any screenshots of that, of the QTL cleanup process, but it's in that handout. Do you guys all have that handout? The QTL protocol, the GMAP, G model protocol. Do you have that handout? Okay.